This is John Rotherer, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 31st of January 2013. John Rotherer, Part 1.
My name is John Michael Rotherer. I was born in Huddersfield in the West Riding of Yorkshire on the 17th of January 1934.
How long did he live in Huddersfield for?
Well, I left to go to university when I was 18 and never went back.
Ah, okay. Where does the name Rotherer come from?
Ah, yes. Now, it is, the origin is Scandinavian. Let's go back a few thousand years.
Please.
But I know from looking at the books written on people's names, and by almost a man who was my headmaster but left before I started that school, wrote a book on people's names, and he had the name Rotherer in it. And it was from there I learned it was originally of Scandinavian origin. That's all I know.
Are you the only Rotherer in the phone book?
No. I am in this area, but I do know there are some in the Nottingham area. And curiously enough, on holiday one, sat on a balcony late at night in Italy. We got talking to the people on the next balcony, and she was talking about who she'd been working for, and it was the coroner of Nottingham. And I said, oh, he's got the name Rotherer. She said, that's right. And I said, he's been coroner a long time, hasn't he? She said, no. He was always appearing in the national press because of unusual cases, but it wasn't him all the time. There was an original Rotherer in the post, then his son took over, and I believe one of the family again took over after that. And I do know that some in the villages around Nottingham, there are people with the name Rotherer.
Has he got a special meaning, the word?
No, I don't know of it.
No. Okay. Tell me about your father. Was he a professional man?
He had his own small business to do with, oddly enough, in the West Riding, to do with cloth and that kind of work. Yes. He was born in the West Riding of Yorkshire. Not far from Huddersfield. I've never been quite sure where. I think it was a place called Kirkburton. But of course, when you get to this stage in life, you realise all the things you'd never asked and never knew.
Yes.
It's interesting.
Was he well educated?
Was I?
Was he well educated?
Not to my knowledge.
Were you?
Well, I went to a good school in Huddersfield, King James, which had had its royal charter in 1608 and was well recognised, and then to Leeds University. I did my geography degree.
Geography,
yes.
Okay. What was the first memory you have of the Antarctic? What was the first inkling you had that it might exist on this planet of ours?
I think when I was very young and when I began to read and read about different places in the world and so on, I always was interested in maps and the world in general. So I was aware that there was an Arctic and an Antarctic, where Europe was and Australia and so on.
Had you read about the heroes?
Not in particular, no, not at that age, no. When I knew I was going to the Antarctic, I started to read then.
So what happened when you left university? What was the next step?
I went straight into the British, the Falkland Islands Defendancy Survey. And I went to begin with for training to the School of Military Survey near Newbury, Hermitage. And then there was some training, but not really much, at the Directorate of Overseas Survey at Tolworth in Surrey.
Why did you apply to FIDS?
Because of my geography degree, very interested in different parts of the world, the opportunity, which in those days was very limited, to get to the Antarctic. And I was quite amazed when I actually got the post.
Do you remember the interview at all?
I remember, yes, part of it. At Mill Bank, the Crown Agents, yes, I do. I think it was a chap called John Green. And I always remember he had a list in front of him. And he seemed to have to tick one column in particular after each question or discussion.
Was it just one-to-one then, you think?
Yes, it was.
Gosh. Why would you want to go as a surveyor?
I had done surveying as part of my geography course. I didn't make that clear. And we did have a whole one Easter field trip to the somewhere near Scarborough on the East Coast, where most of the time was spent surveying.
I did have
a smattering of the knowledge of surveying before I actually joined FIDS.
Okay. Tell me about going south.
The ship was new, with John Biscoe. Again, it was interesting. The first 3 days we spent in our bunks, I think. It was so rough in the Bay of Biscay, it was horrible. But by the time we got down south of the entrance to the Mediterranean, things were warming up, literally. And I always remember passing Madeira, looking at the magnificent cliffs on that island. And we actually did work on the ship. We did painting and scrubbing the deck at times. Not all the time, but there was that kind of work going on.
Who was on the ship with you who you still remember?
Well, Peter Gibbs, I remember. A chap called... No, I nearly said Brian Holmes. I don't think he was on the ship. Good question. I hadn't thought about that part of it.
Okay.
I know we picked up a chap in Montevideo called George Larmore. He'd flown down there with somebody else, or I can't remember, because he'd been appointed more or less at the last minute for that season's work in the Antarctic.
And we're talking about 1950?
We're in 1956. Yeah. We left here at the beginning of December, 50, or late November. Anyway, I know we were in Montevideo a week before Christmas, and we were actually in Port Stanley at Christmas.
What did you make of the Falklands and Stanley?
Oh, quite pleasant, I thought. Very much like Scotland. That was my immediate impression, sailing into Stanley Harbour, that I so much like Scotland. And it was, even when you got off and were walking around the small town of Stanley.
Were you there for a while?
We were there for 2 or 3 days, and then we went south, where we waited at Base W for the arrival of Britannia.
Britannia?
Britannia. The Duke of Edinburgh was on his world tour on Britannia and having a good time from what we understood. We waited, I remember, on the morning of the 1st of January, 1957, New Year's Day, and there was a mist, which was quite unusual in the Antarctic. And suddenly, out of the mist came Britannia. And then he got off with the governor of the Falkland Islands and John Green, I remember. And they came on board for 2 days. And we took them round some of the bases. And then when he went off again, we went all the way back to Stanley for the new year. Because they were having these big celebrations because the Duke was going to be there. And they had horse racing, which, of course, the Duke won when he rode in one of the races. And then after another few days, we came south properly.
See, the first time we came south was merely to be a taxi for the Duke of Edinburgh,
really. Yes, it was, yeah. Yes.
How did he strike you? Was he clean-shaven or a bit scruffy?
I wouldn't say he was scruffy, but he was informal, very much so. Somebody, I think, who you could say, yes, he'd been in the Navy. He wasn't really just a member of the royal family.
Was he mixing with everybody?
Yes, I think so, yes.
You had lunch with him, I think, didn't you?
Sorry?
Did you have lunch with him?
We had lunch, yes. I wasn't on his table. It were only two tables, actually, in our little mess. But we were on a table with the governor and, I think, the ADC to the Duke. But we had drinks with him before lunch in the bar.
There's a story about that, I think, isn't there?
Oh, well, yes, I did write down that he wanted a... I was on bar duty. Somebody was on bar duty every day, different person. I happened to be on bar duty. He wanted a pink gin. I didn't really know what a pink gin was, but I knew you did put the bitters in it. But apparently I put far too much bitters, and he passed the drink back to me and said it was far too strong. The second one was okay. So that was all right.
And was he getting off the ship at each base?
He got off at base W, and I can't remember where. We went to another base. I think it was only one other. It might have been the... I can't remember which one. It was to the north.
So he was just getting off occasionally?
Yes, that's all.
Not all the time. Yeah.
We certainly didn't go down further south because I think the ice was still difficult.
Did he warm to him?
Well, it wasn't really in our presence too much. Mm. I think he was, he was going ashore places, and although he slept on board, he was upstairs in one of, I think, the captain's cabin and accommodation.
I gather his tie was severed at one point.
I can't remember that.
Oh, okay.
No.
Half his tie is pinned on a base wall somewhere in the Antarctic.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I can believe, yeah.
He had been on bases previously to coming down to join us. I think he'd been to Deception, the Argentine Islands, and I think he might have been in the Argentine Islands for New Year's Eve. And apparently it was quite a good thing to be on board on the Britannia on New Year's Eve.
Work started in earnest for you once the new year had dawned and you headed south.
Yes, once we went south a second time, we were busy unloading at various bases with all the supplies and so on. Hope Bay, I remember, in particular. We didn't go back to W, but we went, I think, directly down to Horseshoe. We could get in. The ice hadn't been brilliant the year before. People on the base the year before had really not had any opportunity to sledge at all. So we went in, and we knew we were going to go to a refuge hut, which was going to be built on Blakelock Island in Bigwardan Fjord. And we weren't at our base very long, but Horseshoe, before we set off to erect the base hut up at Blakelock Island.
Who was in that party with you?
Well, me, Peter Gibbs, a chap called Nigel Proctor, who was the geologist, who was going to be with us the whole of that year. Various people who were going to be erecting the base hut and so on.
So the first job was to build the hut and then to occupy it, refuge hut.
Yes. Yeah. It only took about 3 days, if I remember. And then they left and we were left on our own. Me, Peter Gibbs and Nigel Proctor.
Was it in kit form then, the hut?
Sorry?
Was it in kit form?
It was prefabricated, yes. It was really nothing more than a garden hut. It really wasn't. I don't know how we survived.
So what was your mission then? What were you instructed to do in your first season?
Well, to survey what we could. The point of going to Blakelock Island was we could get onto the mainland by going over Blakelock Island and across the Jones Ice Shelf onto the glacier. The Heim Glacier? Yes.
That's right.
And we were going to manhaul with no dogs, no means of transport, only pulling the damn sledges, which we did. And we did quite a bit, but we couldn't do too much. It was only when the sea ice formed, which I think was in March. Late March, it began to form, that we could really get anywhere else.
Were you picking up on the work that had been previously started?
Not really, no.
It was a clean sheet, was it?
Well, work had been done, but I'm sorry, no work had been done by FIDS, as far as I'm aware. There are original things from the 1900s, Charco and all those people, but nothing which FIDS had done before.
So you had some kind of map to work from?
Yes, we did. We had basic maps, yes.
And your job was to clarify those maps?
It was really to identify areas where we could erect trig points and then survey between them triangulation. So they could pinpoint for the work going on back in England exactly where these islands and peaks and bays and were in the world. They had never been actually located properly through that kind of surveying. There was something going on with the Navy too at that time. They had a chap doing some surveying. There was a chap called Angus Erskine, Lieutenant Commander Angus Erskine. In fact, we saw him several times in our time down there. He had been arriving at the Blakelock Hut one day, surprisingly. But he was doing some surveying, and I know that the surveying party was going on from HMS Protector, and they were flying people in helicopters to the tops of peaks and doing it the work by telerometer, where we were slugging it out on the ground and hauling things to the top of these peaks.
Did you not have the telerometers?
No, we didn't. Not then.
So you were using plane tabling?
We just used theodolites, which is an old-fashioned way, really, of doing the work, involving turning little knobs and so on in bitterly cold weather, and your hands got very cold very rapidly.
You had to take your gloves off, I guess, too.
Yeah, well, you did at times, yes.
So tell me about a typical day of surveying, which was really...
Well, it depended on the weather, of course. Too often the typical day was lying in the tent, listening to the wind whistling by the canvas and hearing the snow hitting the canvas, most of it being blown snow. There was never really snowed that much. And it could be quite boring. It happened twice for a week on each occasion. And at the end of that period, you got very weak. And when you got out to dig out the tents and so on and the dogs and what have you, when we did have dogs, it was quite an effort to do it to begin with.
Why were you becoming weak?
Because you're lying in a tent for a week. You're not moving around enough. But you soon got back into the way of things once you started actually doing something, digging the snow away or even just moving around.
How would you pass the time during a layup?
Reading, basically reading or sleeping. If we were actually working during good weather, and if we had dogs or when we were man-hauling, well, it could be quite pleasant. With sledging, you would identify the point where you wanted the trig points, and you would then sledge there. You wouldn't normally go up the day you got there. You would wait till the next day. And then at the peak, back again after building a cairn. Often it could be a snow cairn, which wasn't going to last too long.
What was the function of a cairn?
Well, if you were at one point where you had a cairn, you could then locate the theodolite where the other cairns were, and that is the way you got the triangulation.
So
which was going to pinpoint those particular points on the ground.
You're leaving little landmarks, effectively.
Yes, they send them quite big. We would do star observations at night sometimes. Most of them we did before we left the Blakelock Refuge. we could pinpoint Blakelock then according to the stars. That was quite difficult at times, very difficult.
Because of cloud?
It was cold. You could only do it, of course, when it was a cloudless sky. And then there was the problem of, did we really pinpoint that particular star or not? But I think in the end, because of the work we did, we were pretty good at doing that.
It sounds pretty exhausting kind of work to me.
I wouldn't say so. We didn't do it every day and not every week. We do what we had to do. And then we may not do anything for a week or two. But the other things had to be done at the base. When we got back to Horseshoe, which we did for midwinter, of course, the docks to look after, the dog meat to get, killing of seals, keeping the base set in good order and so on. There was always something to do. And right at the end of the 2 years, I think when people knew they were going to be coming home, and that the ice was not going to last forever. I suppose, in a way, we started to do, shall we say, holiday things. We decided, me and another chap, to go to look at Stonington, to the south of Horseshoe, a very historic base, which had been occupied in the 1930s, or 40s, rather.
Post-war, certainly.
Yeah, and by the Americans.
And Brits.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And also on the way back, we stopped at an Argentinian base. Well, on the way down we did briefly, but on the way back we stayed 2 or 3 nights. That was quite interesting.
How were you travelling?
By dog sledge.
So Horseshoe had its own dogs, did it, for that time?
We had our own teams, yes.
Yeah.
Once we were at Blakelock and the sea ice formed, and when it got towards midwinter, the 21st of June, we knew we could go back to Horseshoe. And we manhauled, the three of us, the sledges back to Horseshoe, where we, from then onwards, we had dog sledges. I had a team, Peter had a team, and Nigel did in the second year, but not the first year.
Tell me about your team.
Well, they were called the Trogs. Apparently, they were based on a cartoon in the Daily Mail. The leader was called Bodger, and he was very good at leading. And the other dog, which sticks in my mind, was one called Fluke, who was always in the two behind the leader. He could have been a leader too if the other one had somehow disappeared. But they were a very good team.
When you first arrived, how did you come to terms or do your deal with the dogs?
Quite easily. You have some training. Behind the Horseshoe was a small bay called Back Bay. We called it Back Bay. I don't think they do now. And we would have training there. And the commands we had to give to the dogs, to go left and right, or to stop, or to start, and so on. You only needed really 4 commands. And they were very good at it. They understood it because they'd been trained already by the people on base.
But there's always that slight hiatus when the handler, the human being in that team is changed over. So when you arrive,
oh yes,
you're a stranger.
I've no idea who had that team beforehand. Because remember, the previous year there'd been very poor ice and they hadn't been able to sledge at all really. I would imagine those dogs, except perhaps in Back Bay, had been on the base the whole year.
They were itching to go, were they?
Oh, I think so, yes. Yeah.
A Blakelock Point is a very isolated spot in a very isolated world. I'm wondering how the three of you coped with being so far removed.
Well, I think we coped very well, yes. I mean, it was isolated. We had radio contact, of course, with base. But I remember Peter Gibbs had and Nigel Proctor, they had both been in Africa, and they had been used to going out into the, shall we say, the wild areas. So they were quite used to this kind of thing, but not in a cold, snowy, icy place, of course.
How about you? How did you adjust?
No, I was okay. I had been on field trips in this country through my geography degree and so on, and I had no problem at all with it.
Did you have any contact with the rest of the planet? You could radio back to Horseshoe, but were you able to pick up the BBC or talk to people elsewhere?
Well, we had it. In those days, the radios, you had to pedal to get contact. And or was it like that? I think it was that. Anyway, whatever it was, it was quite a business. Yeah. And all you really needed to do was contact your base, or they contacted us at specific times already identified in the beforehand. And you got quite fed up with all this winding of things. So as soon as everything had been said which needed to be said, you were glad to stop using it.
I've heard it said that it is impossible to pedal and Morse at the same time.
Yes. Well, one would pedal and the other would Morse. Yes.
Just tell me a bit more about Blakelock Point and Blakelock Refuge. You say it was a small hut, but how well equipped was it?
Well, it wasn't. It was basically a garden hut, and we just had the basics, primer stoves, very basic equipment. All our cooking was done on primer stoves. There was nothing special about it. In fact, you could say we were using the equipment in the hut, which we were going to use on our field trips with dragging the sledge, or later with the dogs. There was nothing much else. And then I'm trying to think about the insulation. I can't remember much. There was some insulation, but it could get quite cold. There was, I remember, we had an upper story in it, which was only about that far from the roof, but with a ladder up, and we kept food and things. But it was warmer up there than it was down here. Until we thought, hold on a minute, the fumes from the primer stove and so on were collecting up there in that area. So we did stop sleeping up there.
Oh, for fear of carbon monoxide?
Well, I don't know at that time we knew much about carbon monoxide. I think it was a bit unpleasant, the fumes.
Did you sense that at the time you were doing something really unusual with your life?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
In those days, yes. The fact, you know, am I really here in the Antarctic? Have I actually got here? Yes. To me, anyway.
And what was so important about mapping the land?
Important?
Yeah. Why bother to map the land?
Well, I
don't mean that to be an impertinent question to a man who's just done it, but I'm just wondering whether there was more than one reason for doing it.
I suppose, really, you see, this country in its colonial days had been used to mapping everything which was colonial. East Africa, West Africa, the West Indies, you name it.
If it was pink.
It was being mapped by the Directorate of Colonial Survey in those days. And, of course, Grahamland was claimed by this country. So I suppose it had to be mapped because it was one of our, not an actual colony, but a claimed area. And as the Argentinians and Chileans were also claiming it, also had bases down there, they were also doing surveying. We clearly had to do that, I think.
So surveying the land was another way of backing up your claim, was it?
I've never actually heard it said, but that was the impression we had, yes.
Did you recognise at the time that there was a political aspect to your presence?
Oh, yes, we did, because, we knew why the other bases were there, the Argentinians and the Chileans. For example, when we stayed with the Argentinians at General San Martin base, it was quite obvious that one of the number on the base was a political agent from Buenos Aires, and he was there to make sure everything went according to the plan as it was understood in Buenos Aires. Yes, it was very much, because I had the most unfortunate occurrence there. One night we were there, they played this game, and how old do you think he is? And then they said to me, how old do you think he is? And this is the political man. And I said, 32? He was 21. And he didn't like it at all.
Well, my next question was going to be, did his welcome differ from that of the rest of the Argentinian?
He was a bit aloof.
Yeah.
Yes, aloof. That's how I'd describe it. He would participate in the meals and so on, he'd be there and so on. But you always got the impression that he was stood back from the others.
Did you have to hand over a protest note?
No. No, we didn't. In fact, the base leader was very welcoming indeed. He came quite clearly from, I would say, a very wealthy family in Argentina. And they did, I know, have somewhere out on the Pampas, apart from some accommodation in Buenos Aires. It was a very pleasant chap.
And you got on well with the artist, did you?
Yes, we did. Mm.
Were there any tricky moments in that first year? Any scary incidents?
It was always said that when you went to the Antarctic for work, whether it's surveying, geology or whatever, you had to go for 2 years, because the first year was spent learning how you do it and how you get through the Antarctic weather and so on. Mm. You had to acclimatise to it. You had to learn how to live through it. But that first year, I don't remember anything scary, really.
Were you doing any significant trips?
We started to do proper... yes, we did. We were still working. Although we went back to the Horseshoe, we did go back to Blakelock and work from there as well. So we were then sledging all around the fjords, Bourgeois, and Bigwardin, La Berthe Fjord, and eventually over to Adelaide Island.
Did all those expeditions go smoothly?
One of mine didn't, going over the glacier behind, yes, when some of the dogs went down, yes.
Oh, yes. Tell me the story, please, John.
Well, we were going to Base W. This is the second year. Mm. I and two others were sledging to W. And going up behind glacier the second day, suddenly, my dock team, the middle part, they fell into the crevasse. Fortunately, the leading dog and Fluke and so was still on that side, and dogs here, but three or four fell down. But only two we managed to get out the next morning, because it was getting dark. And the next day, there was a blizzard. We couldn't do anything. But it was only the following day that one of our number went down and got the two remaining dogs out that were still alive.
So some had died in the process?
We don't. They know no sign of them.
Never saw them again.
Because of the blizzard, a lot of snow had gone into the crevasse.
Mm-hmm. So the decision to delay the rescue, was that, I suppose you had to do that, you couldn't...
There was no way we could do anything.
Yeah.
I think my memory is correct here, but as I was talking to you, I began to wonder, was there a whole day or not? I'm not sure. I could check my diary.
There was certainly a delay, was there, before you...
There was a delay, yes. Yeah. Because overnight, it was getting dark when this happened, and there's nothing much we could do.
you describe it in your notes as an explosion of snow.
Yes.
So it was a snow bridge collapsing, I guess, wasn't it?
It was a snow bridge across a crevasse, which was quite wide. We didn't realise it was there, even from looking at the aerial photographs. We had aerial photographs done by Huntings, and we used to look to see if there were crevasses. We never saw this one. And the thing is, once there's a bridge over with snow, there's a difference in temperature between above and below. The sledge weight caused something to happen, and that's why it blew up.
So were you able to reassemble the trogs after the loss of a couple of dogs?
Yes. We were down to 7 dogs from 9 dogs. Mm.
Huntings, of course, were doing lots of aerial photography at that point, weren't they?
Yes.
So, in a way, they were already overtaking you in terms of the survey work that could be done.
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm.
Were you aware of that at the time, do you think?
What, the aerial photo?
Well, were you aware of the change, the imminent change in the way that surveying was going to be done?
Well, we knew the Navy were better equipped than we were. And we were all using Hunting aerial photographs, which had been taken, I think, the previous year before we went down.
So it was part of your job to actually plot those on the ground?
Yes.
Tie them in?
Mm.
So you were in the field with the aerial photographs?
Yes.
Weren't they largely white?
No. This is the thing about the Antarctic. Because so many people, when you got back, thought, oh, it's just snow and ice. No, not in Grenland. A tremendous amount of rock was exposed. There's a lot more exposed today, I understand. Mm. Much more. But, no, there's quite a lot of rock points. For example, at Rothera Point, we built a trig point because there was a lot of rock exposed. And also, it rose up quite a nice height. And the big cairn we built on the top could be identified from other points around, from miles away.
Is this the cairn that you left the note in?
Yes.
This is a note from Alan Wright, who followed you on. At Rothera Point, there is an unusual circular hollow cairn, apparently built by John Rothera and Peter Gibbs when they surveyed the point. A year or more later, Alan Wright was part of a survey team based out of Adelaide Island. They returned to the Rothera Point as part of the survey they were doing to investigate linking Marguerite Bay bases, found the cairn, and inside it a cocoa tin with a note from John and Peter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what was behind that?
Well, I don't know. I understand that note was on display in the first base hut at Rothera Point, at that time anyway. That Jim Fallis told me that when he came once and we talked about the Antarctic.
But why did what did you say?
Well, I think we said some rather silly things about probably some creatures we invented called, I think they were crodats or something.
Crodats?
Krodats. I think that was the name. But we, I suppose it might have originated when we were at Blakelock Island. And we were going around and the crodats live up there. We invented these peculiar people. No idea what they looked like. And I think there was something like that. I can't remember the rest of it.
So you were leaving a note for them, were you?
Yes. Well, no. It was for anybody who came. And obviously, they did come. Somebody did come and get it.
Alan Wright, the following year.
Yes. Where was he on coming from before he came?
I'd have to look it up, John. He doesn't say, but...
No.
He was the following year's survey team, anyway.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it wasn't a practical note with instructions or advice.
Oh, no. I don't think so.
The cairn was unusual and circular. Is that standard design?
Well, I think we'd regard it as a standard. I think the point there was so much loose rock that we could build a really decent cairn in many places. There wasn't much material, and this is why, to begin in some places anyway, you had to revert to building snow cairns, which were not going to last. but you always put a red flag on top. And we were able, because we did it over a relatively short period of time, those particular areas, to use those snow cairns before they disintegrated with the wind or perhaps a bit of melt in the summer and so on. But with a rock cairn, you knew it was there for good unless somebody came along and dismantled it.
Everybody's referring to this point as being Rothera Point, but what were you calling it at that time?
I don't think we did. No. The other point thing about Rothera Point was, it was when we had that unfortunate business of losing three men from Horseshoe, Rothera Point was where we all sledged to at one point before we went further south into the bay or down to Avian Island where the Argentinian refuge hut was. Because we knew it was a very good rocky area where there was plenty of space to erect the tents and so on. And it was true that we all used to work from there, and then we came back there when we had done our, effort at trying to find them.
But it didn't have a name at that point?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Can we talk a bit about the loss of Black, Statham and Stride from Horseshoe? I guess you knew them.
I knew David Statham, because he was on the Biscoe when I went down. I got to know him quite well. He was, I believe, the cousin of Brian Statham, the Lancashire fast bowler.
I didn't know that.
Well, I'm not absolutely certain, but I'm pretty sure I was told that. He didn't tell me that.
Lancashire and England.
And England, yes, very much so. I didn't really know Jeff Stride. I'd spoken to him, but I didn't know him. I knew Stan Black a bit, but not for long. It was only on the ship, really. Because when we went down, they got off at different bases. And then I went further south. But, of course, when the Biscoe came in at the middle year, in between the 2 years, they were coming on to Horseshoe. So I met them again then.
What was the first news you had that there was a problem?
We were sledging up the northern end of La Berthe Fjord, and we had a radio scared at a certain time. And when we latched onto Base Y, Horseshoe, they were talking to somebody else about the fact that these three men had left Horseshoe 2 days before, and there'd been no sign of them. And they had identified the fact the sea ice had gone out from the southern end of, La Berthe Fjord, I suppose. We broke into the sked and asked for more information. And from then we said we would search what we could on the southern end of La Berthe Fjord.
And who went out and did the search?
Well, we searched, and then, of course, we regrouped at Horseshoe. Peter Gibbs and people came up, and Henry Wyatt came up from Base East, Donington, and they followed us. But we got to the Avian Island before they did. Two sledge parties.
Who's we, John? You and...
Well, me, Nigel Proctor, and I think it was a chap called Hilson, I think. We got to Avian Island before, and we went out to the Dion Islands the next day. No sign, of course, of them anywhere. There was plenty of sea ice around then, because time had gone on from the initial information that they'd gone missing. But then the next day, I think Peter Gibbs and Henry Wyatt arrived, or John Paisley, yes. And they went out to get into the bay. They went to the Dions again and to the Faroe Islands, and I think somewhere else too, some rock or other. But there was no sign of anybody.
Were you aware at that time that FIDS HQ had actually forbidden there to be any rescue attempt.
Forbidden?
Yeah.
Sorry, forbidden.
When Peter Gibbs was in touch with Fitz HQ in London about rescue attempts or searching parties, he was advised not to conduct any.
No, I didn't know. No, I didn't.
Because he just ignored them, basically. And
yes. Well, he would. yes, he would.
What was morale like at that time? Because I guess you realised you were fighting a losing battle.
Well, I think we did because, I mean, we could see, when we first learned of what the problem was and when we sledged south down La Berthe, we could see that the sea ice had gone out too. And we thought, oh, God, if they'd camped on the sea ice, they would have had it. There's no way. And then, of course, this business of the docks turning up one by one.
How do you mean?
Well, the dogs they'd had, that most of them turned up at Base Y individually over the next few weeks. And the Argentinians down at their base informed our base that there were two or three of our dogs running round their island, their particular location. So we thought, well, their dogs didn't just bat themselves off the trace. Somebody cut them loose at the last moment. They must have done.
So, although we don't know what happened, the inference is that the three men realised they weren't going to make it back and they cut the dogs free.
I think that's what we all thought, yes.
On the grounds that a dog might get back, but a human being wouldn't.
The dogs, I would think, because they're low, four legs, they could survive on a large ice floe. This is my, or what I always thought. Whereas the men on two legs, very difficult, very unsteady, I would think. But we don't know, really. We just don't know.
So was the ice ever blown back in again? I mean, were the dogs coming back because the wind had changed?
It must have blown in again. The ice floes must have done. They didn't all come back, but most of them did.
And had they swum? Was it evident whether they'd swum?
I don't know. I doubt it.
I was
never aware of anybody suggesting that the dogs had been in the water. They may have done. And, of course, the dogs would survive lower temperatures and worse conditions than the human beings would.
Yeah. Did it change anything, the way you thought or the practices you followed?
Well, I think then it was always understood we don't camp on sea ice again until, of course, you suddenly realise one day you were camping on sea ice. But after that sea ice went out and it reformed, it really formed in a very incredible way. It was really thick ice that year and the year after. Very thick ice. And I think we all, as you do in the Antarctic, you get a bit blasé. You start doing things which afterwards you think, why did we really do that? Should we have done that? Like coming down from a cairn one day in Hanusi Bay with two others. We're coming down and we knew at the end of the ice slope was an ice cliff. But we came back down a very slippy area. And then we curved round to go down to what we could get onto the sea ice. And I thought afterwards, we're a bit stupid. If we had slipped, we'd have gone straight over the ice cliff. And I suppose on the sea ice, several times I found myself on ice, especially near the land, the coast, where it was a bit thin for some reason. There may have been a current or something. And you have to keep your eyes open. But you assume, I think, all the time, oh, everything's going to be fine.
Did you never fear for your life in your...
No, I didn't. Time. No. No.
Tell me about Peter Gibbs. What sort of man...
About?
Peter Gibbs. What sort of man is
he? Oh, no, this is... I must be careful, isn't it? Well, he was... he was quite an interesting person, really. um, he was very, I think, he knew a lot about Africa, and he would talk about it a lot. In fact, he would sing Afrikaans songs. I think his father was the Dean of Cape Town at one time, I think. But he'd been out and learned how to survive in the backlands or whatever, the outback. Well, that sounds a bit Australian. But he'd learned by going out with people who told him how to survive in these conditions.
And was he transferring that experience to the Antarctica?
I think so, yes. He could... Well, both Nigel and I thought we had to be reining back at times. Like Peter would think, say, oh, I think we'll build a cairn there, and we would look, and it was really impossible. So we would have to put our feet down once or twice. We really did.
He struck me as a very authoritative military man.
Yes.
Beautifully spoken.
I don't think he had a military experience, though, did he?
No.
Not to my knowledge, he didn't, no. Oh, he was very much in command, yes.
Was he fair?
Oh, I think so. I got on quite well with him.
Did the whole base get on well together?
What, which base? Which
Horseshoe, initially, and then the second year you were elsewhere, weren't you?
Yes, I was at Base W. He went down to Base E the last year, until all this business with finding, trying to locate the missing men came up. And then we were all back, really, centred on Horseshoe. Sorry, I've forgotten the question.
So have I.
About something about everybody on the base.
Was Horseshoe generally a harmonious base?
I think so, yes.
And is the same true of Detail the following year?
I don't know.
Were you not at Detail?
Oh, Detail, yes. It was okay, yeah. Yes. I can't remember much about Detail, actually.
That was your second year, wasn't it?
It was, but I didn't get there until late.
Why not?
Because we were still surveying down from the refuge hut at Blakelock. And it was only later in the year that we went back to W. But we did quite a lot of sledging once we got to W. In fact, probably more sledging in Anusi Bay for quite a while than we did originally down the first year in the Horseshoe area.
And was this to do with surveying, or was this more jolly?
Oh, it was surveying, really. Yeah. Yes.
So, effectively, you were moving down to Detail because you finished the work in the Horseshoe area?
Basically, yes. Well, we knew work needed to be done around Detail. There was a chap called Brownfoot, who was the base leader. He was a surveyor. I think he was a surveyor. I can't remember him at the Director of Overseas Survey, but I think he was. And he certainly did some surveying in Anusi Bay.
So was life quite different at Detail compared to your first year?
Yeah, very much so. I think, really, most people in the British Antarctic Survey wanted to be in the Marguerite Bay area. There's no doubt about that. People who were further north in the first year, like David Statham and so on, were very keen to get down to Marguerite Bay because it was, it was more, I think, what they expected to find when they went to the Antarctic. But if you were at Deception and so on, you weren't going to be sledging for hundreds of miles or whatever because there was no prospect of that. Base W, I can't really remember too much about it. I wasn't really there that long.
Did he not spend some time at Danko Island as well?
No.
No?
No.
Can I ask you a bit more about the search for the three?
Yes, yes.
Where did you start off from and what kind of territory were you covering?
Well, we were out in La Boeuf Field when we heard about this. So we then went south down La Boeuf Field towards the open sea that we knew had happened in Marguerite Bay. And we searched what we could around that area, but found nothing. But then we went back to Blakelock and then down to Horseshoe, where things were being organised. And then we all came back again, and the sea ice had frozen. So we knew we could then get further south into the bay. And that's when we went to what is now Rothera Point, and then to Avian Island, the Argentina refuge, and sledged out to the Dions and so on.
Let's take a break, John, and we'll
yes.
pick up.
Would you like some more tea?
Please.